Greetings, people of the planet Earth, and welcome to another episode of the Evolved Idiots podcast. Today, I'm flying solo and we'll be looking at asteroidal evidence that may explain the story of Sodom and Gomorrah from the Bible. We'll talk about psychedelic pharmaceuticals, Jungle Boys getting raided last week. Also, a third of programmers consume cannabis while smoking, a new study says, and how that may affect the job market, as well as guns and cannabis ownership and the legalities around that. Also, a new study showing a severe drop in use of cannabis by youth in the communities. But first, a simple reflection on Biden's first year in office. It's been a year. There were a lot of promises made, and really nothing has been done towards the cannabis industry and all the promise that he had said. Really makes it feel like talk and theater, but really no action. If you recall, he actually said during a town hall event in October 2020, we should decriminalize marijuana. I don't believe anybody should be going to jail for drug use, said Biden at the time. Campaign pledges that he has talked about but never actually followed through on. One is that cannabis still has not been federally decriminalized. Two, people in federal prison still remain there over nonviolent cannabis offenses. And three, cannabis still has not been rescheduled under the Controlled Substances Act. Now, to take this a step further, he even proposed, that's right, Biden even proposed to block Washington, D.C. from being able to legalize cannabis. When you combine that in another proposal where he proposed punishing the White House staff who were honest about their past cannabis use. And all this really reflects on the sense that, are we really dealing with somebody who is a true advocate? And I think if people are honest about the expectations that it's a Democrat in office and the hopes that legislation and will come through for the cannabis industry, I think they really need to look at both Biden's record as well as Harris's record. Neither one of them are really fans of the cannabis industry, and it shows. A recent survey from YouGov and The Economist showed that 54% said that Biden has made little to no progress with cannabis reform. He actually has the authority to unilaterally issue mass pardons for people with federal cannabis convictions, and still, for some reason, hasn't taken that action. Now, I know COVID has been a big issue for a lot of people, but this is something that he could literally do with the swipe of a pen. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development said it is required to continue denying federally assisted housing to people who use marijuana, even if they're acting in compliance with their state laws. Another fallacy where we have conflict in regulations, and something has to be done to correct this. In fact, you could even look at the Department of Veterans Affairs, who said last year that it continues to oppose a bill that would require it to conduct clinical trials into the therapeutic potential of cannabis for military veterans. Why are we still fighting to give medicinal access to veterans? If anybody has earned the right to treat their health conditions in the manner that they deem best, it should be a veteran. And I don't understand why the VA, of all places, who should be about the health and well-being of veterans, is opposed to even looking into this. It just continues to show the hypocrisy that plagues our whole political system, not just on this issue, but on a plethora of issues. In fact, the FBI quietly updated its hiring policies last year to make it so candidates are only automatically disqualified from joining the agency if they admit to having used marijuana within 1 year of applying. However, They later revised the policy to add a stipulation that applicants are ineligible if they've used cannabis more than 24 times after turning age 18. So we still also have no federal hemp regulations for CBD. And the House just keeps passing the Safe Banking Act. I think they just did this for the sixth time a few weeks ago. And again, it has little chance in the Senate, and it's not going anywhere. And it makes it really feel like it's just a bunch of political theater. They said these promises on the campaign trail, and they've not acted on any of it. It's really opened up the door for Republicans who are now pushing for rescheduling and pardons more so or just as hard as the Democrats. And it's really an interesting opportunity where if the Democrats are not very careful, the Republicans are going to swoop in and steal this issue and that voter base if they're not careful. While we're talking about the government, a new study came out showing an unprecedented decline in cannabis use by young people. It came out by the University of Michigan. The data showed a decline year over year in the use of cannabis and other controlled substances. Use itself was self-reported, so take that for what you will, but the authors reported, quote, "The percentage of students who reported using cannabis in all forms, including smoking and vaping, within the last year decreased significantly for 8th, 10th, and 12th grade students. In fact, 38% had a year-over-year reduction among 8th graders. 10th graders had a 38% decline year over year, and 12th graders also had a 13% decrease year over year. Quote, "We have never seen such dramatic decreases in drug use among teens in just a one-year period," said Nora Volkow, director of the U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse, which funded the study. She continues, "These data are unprecedented and highlight one unexpected potential consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic, which caused seismic shifts in the day-to-day lives of adolescents." In September of 2021, Dr. Volkow acknowledged that legalization has not led to an increase in use in and among teenagers. These findings came just months after the U.S. NIH released similar conclusions showing year-over-year decreases in ages 12 to 17. Now, I know that oftentimes people are always concerned about legalization, meaning increased access, and it is about increased access for those that are legally supposed to have access, not for youth. And the industry, I think, you know, vast majority of the industry, I don't want to speak for them, but there's definitely a sense of responsibility when it comes to preventing youth access. And by simply, you know, the metrics, I've talked about this before. When you increase legal access, you essentially are taking away market share from illicit shops, drug dealers on the streets, and so forth. And when you take away their market base, you pull away from their bottom line, which makes it harder for them to even stay in business. The fewer of those there are out there from the illicit market, the fewer opportunities there are for young people to actually go out and procure these products. Might I also mention the illicit opportunities, the dealers on the streets, the illicit shops, they're untested products. So it's doubly bad because it's not just that youth are using products that they shouldn't be, but they're using potentially dangerous products that they shouldn't be. So I think what we're seeing here is that by increasing access, we're actually decreasing the access in the illicit market, which is ideally what we're trying to accomplish, which also has a trickle-down effect in that it limits access for youth in the communities. Exactly kind of what we had intended on having happen when the whole legalization effort was started. And so I think that's some positive news heading in a right direction. Also kind of dealing with the federal level, I think is another issue that doesn't get talked about a lot because oftentimes To be quite honest, cannabis doesn't really mix with firearms. And I'm not saying that the two should mix together. But however, there is a Federal Gun Control Act of 1968, if you don't know about it, which actually prohibits cannabis customers, legal or otherwise, from possessing firearms. This is because, again, cannabis is still considered a Schedule I controlled substance, which, again, let's reschedule that. But that hasn't been done yet. So a good example of dealing with this issue is the federal form that's required for purchasing a firearm, which asks, are you an unlawful user of or addicted to marijuana or any depressant, stimulant, narcotic drug, or other controlled substance? The form does not specify that even if marijuana is lawful in the applicant's state of residence, it remains unlawful in the eyes of the Bureau. The ATF Public Information Officer Crystal McCoy cited recently a 2011 open letter penned by Arthur Herbert, the Bureau's Assistant Director of Enforcement Programs and Services. Quote, marijuana, as mentioned above, is listed in the Controlled Substances Act as a Schedule I controlled substance, and federal law does not provide any exception allowing the use of marijuana for medicinal or recreational purposes, even if authorized by state law, Herbert wrote at the time. Additionally, McCoy cited a 2011 case in which S. Rowan Wilson, a medical marijuana patient in Nevada, claimed in court that the policy violated her constitutional rights. However, in 2016, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against Wilson and in favor of the U.S. Department of Justice and the ATF. And the truth is, this policy is unlikely to change unless one of two things happen. One, as I mentioned before, marijuana or cannabis is descheduled from the list of federally controlled substances. Two, the Gun Control Act is amended to include exceptions for medical marijuana patients and states with legal cannabis markets, which absolutely should be done. It's beyond ridiculous to think that someone who either, uses cannabis from a medicinal standpoint, or someone even that uses it periodically or occasionally from a recreational or a health and wellness standpoint, is incapable of being responsible with a firearm. In fact, I would say I would prefer probably more cannabis users to have firearms than other types when you compare it to other types of substances that you have to be that are age restricted, such as alcohol or even prescriptions. And I think that's really what it comes in, where the factors really come into play. We don't have strong prevention and we allow people to own guns that can go out and drink as much as they want whenever they want and own a gun. Same thing with prescription pills. There's no restrictions on that. And I think, if we're not going to have restrictions around those things in particular, then I really think it's time for the government to reflect upon this and look at this and change this as well, because this and a simple rescheduling of cannabis would resolve this problem probably most easily. And so I think that's where we really need to try and push on that. Also, I've been noticing on the news a lot about the job market. People talking about, well, there's labor shortages, we can't find workers, we can't do that. One group that has been, or one sector, I should say, that has been really impacted has been programming. A new study actually came out, again, University of Michigan here, called Hashing It Out, A Survey of Programmers, Cannabis Usage, Perception, and Motivation. And it showed that more than one third of software programmers say that they have used cannabis while working, many saying that it promotes creativity and gets them into the zone. This was a survey of 803 developers, so it wasn't a vast survey, but it was a reasonable survey. But they were asked how cannabis factors into their work. And many really touted the advantages of, like they said there, getting into the zone, promoting creativity, really making it more engaging and, in their minds, more effective and higher quality and more efficient, because it allows them to really, you know, it's probably very similar to how if you're an athlete and you've ever been on the court and you just can't miss, you know, you're in the zone. So they say, same kind of a concept, I think, that they're trying to get out here with programming. However, drug testing policies remain very common in the programming sector, and this may be contributing to shortages in hiring opportunities for certain types of jobs. In fact, in 2014, former FBI Director James Comey, who you may remember, was interested in loosening employment policies around cannabis because some prospective agents basically wanted to smoke weed, as he said, on the way to the interview, says Comey. But, you know, I think there is something to that, though. It's a younger generation. It's a new generation. It's a generation that has grown up more accepting. I grew up under the war on drugs propaganda. I remember it. This generation that's coming up now, they, you know, people that are in their 20s, they didn't grow up under that type of propaganda. And so they're more open to it. It's more accepting. And I think when you also look at how people use, going back to prescription drugs, like pharmaceuticals such as Adderall and things like that to help increase their work performance, I think it's ridiculous to not at least consider cannabis on that same level of acceptance. In fact, the study showed that, quote, "This prohibition of cannabis use in software engineering has contributed to a widely reported hiring shortage for certain U.S. government programming jobs. The survey showed that 35% had tried cannabis while programming or completing another software engineering related task. 73 said that they've consumed cannabis while working in the past year. 53% consumed cannabis while programming at least 12 times, and 27% used at least twice a week. 4% use cannabis while working on a nearly daily basis. And 91% of the participants say cannabis should be legal for both recreational and medicinal use, compared to just 60% of the general population in 2021. I think this kind of shows where certain demographics, certain sectors are more open to this, and it's more a part of the job that they're doing. So cannabis can be complementary to some activities, as we've talked about before, and I think this is one of those. And I think you can kind of see that discrepancy there, where people who are in that sector sort of see that and they sort of understand that, and it's a factor for them to consider, as where maybe a general population, there's still a bit of a discrepancy there, because maybe they don't work in a job where they, you know, understand that cannabis could be beneficial to that job in some way. And so I think there's a little bit there, but the real question is, are hiring practices, drug testing policies in these job sectors, are they limiting and contributing to job shortages in these areas? Should we reevaluate both at the governmental level as well as the private level in our hiring practices to really reevaluate this? I think obviously you're seeing this kind of come into fruition with states opening up to legalization and that starting to change a lot of things, but there are obviously still a lot of sectors that are more conservative when it comes to this issue. That being said, there are obviously jobs where you should not consume cannabis. If you're operating heavy machinery, you're a driver for anything, you know, there are certain things you shouldn't be consuming cannabis while working. But if you're a programmer, if there are certain types of jobs that I think it certainly should be discussed as to whether or not there is maybe a broader conversation as to how cannabis can be can complement a certain job or task. Making big news this week also, this past week, was Jungle Boys being raided. It really had everybody here in the California market, here especially in Southern California, really talking this week, because Jungle Boys, you know, is really considered kind of an elite, one of the premier brands, I think, in the industry, from many respects. You know, they've kind of been known as a bit of a bootstrap company, trying to really get their way into success, which they have absolutely done. They're looking to expand. They have really high quality product. You know, there's a lot of good things, I think, about Jungle Boys also, and maybe most importantly, is that they're not big corporate. You know, from their perspective, they're a local operator that has just really you know, grown from within, and that's how they've really funded their growth. And I think that's why the industry as a whole was very upset when they were sort of treated in this manner by the California Department of Tax and Fee Administration. You know, I mean, Jungle Boys and any operator who has successfully, you know, went through Los Angeles's application process and operating regulations and requirements knows that it has been a mess. And it's very difficult for a city that has ran their program so poorly to then turn around and be so tight on its regulations. It's something a little bit hypocritical about that to some extent, but what we're really looking at here with regard to this situation is a fear that we have returned to some sort of barbaric time before Prop 64, before, you know, we have a legal market here in California. And just to reflect on this a little bit, I'm reading a little bit from an article here out of High Times, where Ivan from Jungle Boys actually spoke with High Times and says, quote, "At 5 o'clock in the evening, we're all sitting inside the shop. It's the first of the month, so we're all paying our bills. We look up at the camera and see one car, two cars, three cars, four cars. We watch them come up, and my first thought was either they're chasing someone inside of our building or someone that worked for us maybe has a warrant or something. Continuing, we started seeing a roundup of all our employees into the front lobby area, where we were like, are we being raided? Right next to the office, two cops came with guns on us, put them in our face, tell us to get to the fucking ground. This is basically a raid. And we're like, what the? I've never seen it where you have highway patrol, undercovers, LAPD, sheriff, every agency there all working together," end quote. The story behind this is that all sounds very dramatic, and obviously it is very dramatic. There was a lot of force being used, there at least more so than what was necessary when we get into the details here. What I want people to keep in mind is all of those agencies coming out for an action against an operator, and think about the costs of all of those people involved from the law enforcement agencies. Think about what this raid cost taxpayers. And you tell me if, by the time we get to this, if you think this was a good use of taxpayer money. So this was actually caused by a discrepancy over a fine with the CDTFA from when their offices were closed during the pandemic and operators simply couldn't pay their taxes in cash. And despite the fact that last year, Jungle Boys paid $18 million in taxes to them, law enforcement decided to take this level of action against Jungle Boys, apparently for only $66,000. The other factor here is that it seems that Jungle Boys already had a hearing date set regarding the $66,000. They were trying to charge them late fees, and Jungle Boys simply appealed that and was waiting on the date for the hearing on that appeal. The CDTFA inspects California cannabis retail. So typically what they would do is they would maybe come in, ask to see the last few invoices, check some paperwork, make sure everything's in order. And that's kind of the, you know, extent of it most of the time. Jungle Boys did that. They provided the paperwork. They did what they were being asked to do. And then continuing in the story from High Times, Ivan continued, quote, "They won't talk to our lawyer. They won't look at our appeal paperwork. They just basically said, we're taking all the money inside of the building." And I'm like, wait, what? This is over $66,000? End quote. That's right. That was my same thought. All this for $66,000? Here's the kicker. The CDTFA took $174,000, even cleaning out the tip jars for the bud tenders. The CDTFA told High Times, quote, "This is our standard procedure for cannabis businesses or any business. We're not singling out any industry or type of business. If you owe taxes in California, we do our best to collect what is due." Now, really? Let's examine that. First of all, this is your standard procedure for both cannabis businesses or any kind of business. I don't see other businesses being raided by multiple departments all at once over $66,000 in this way. Now, that's the other question. Let's bring this back. How does this make smart decision fiscally by the city and law enforcement? Do you really think that moving all of that into play for this raid was worth $66,000? Or do you think there's a possibility that the raid actually cost the city and taxpayers way more than $66,000? The other question I have here is, if you're a good operator and you've played the rules, why is the city, why is law enforcement taking this sort of behavior, this sort of action? You know, it's interesting to me because law enforcement does come to the industry and they do ask, they want help from legal operators. Help us shut down illicit operators. Help us shut down street dealers. Help us do this in the community. Help us do that. But what are you helping us do? When you treat the industry like this, especially a beloved brand like this, you're not going to get that cooperation out of the industry, just plain and simple. It's not likely to happen. And I don't understand that. I don't understand why this action would be taken, especially when there was already a hearing date set for this dispute. It's not like they just didn't pay taxes and just ignored all the bills or all the letters in the mail, so to speak. Now, I'm sure the city and the CDTFA, they have their side of the story, but I find it hard to believe that this is standard operating procedure to collect taxes for just any old business. I find that very hard to believe. I also find it difficult to understand how they can legally clean out $174,000 of cash on premises when they only were owed $66,000. Will Jungle Boys get that money back? It seems to me that this was a terrible way to enforce regulations. It was a very poor choice by law enforcement and the city itself. Even from a perception standpoint, even if they were legally able to do it and they were justified legally in taking this kind of action. Perceptually, if you want to build a relationship with the industry, this is not the way to do it. And this is why people are so critical of California regulation. This is why people are so critical of it. They can't seem to shut down illicit operations. They don't ever have resources when we talk to them and we tell them about illicit operators and we tell them about street dealers and how the illicit market is working. They never seem to have the resources to do anything about that. But yet they can muster up the vast resources to come down And, you know, I don't know, this kind of reminds you of a gangster movie from back in the day, you know, like the gangsters come in and they're like, hey, you know, you got a nice store here. You want to keep it open? We're going to take everything in the cash register and then you can keep doing business. How's that? You know, that's kind of what it's like. That's what it seems like. So that has been a hot story. And I would love to know kind of everybody's thoughts on that. You know, was this action justified? What do you think about Jungle Boys being treated this way? Should law enforcement, you know, really reevaluate their desire, how they're going about trying to develop a relationship with the industry? Because this is not going to do it. Moving on, we're going to touch on a little bit of psychedelicness and the pharmaceuticals. As we know, psychedelics is a very exciting field right now. But what does its future really look like as its industry develops? You know, and I think that's a really valid question. And if you go back and think and go all the way back into the beginning, you know, LSD itself has been around since 1943 when it was discovered by a Swiss chemist who accidentally ingested it. Talk about a surprise. And that led to the popularization of psilocybin mushrooms by 1957. And then during that time period, scientists found a plethora of evidence for those type of drugs' efficacy as a treatment. But in the 1960s, psychedelics became associated with the counterculture of the time. And institutional support obviously waned, research died off, and really nothing happened because in 1970, the Controlled Substances Act classified LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, and DMT as Schedule I controlled substances, the most restrictive designation for drugs with, quote, no medical potential and strong likelihood for abuse. That basically led to no research for 30 years in this area. David Nichols, a professor emeritus of pharmacology at Purdue University, says, quote, most grant agencies didn't fund any kind of research unless it was negative, end quote. In 2000, John Hopkins University School of Medicine professor and neuroscientist Roland Griffiths obtained government approval to give high doses of psilocybin to healthy volunteers for the first time in 30 years. That eventually led to a 2006 study, which showed that one dose of the drug appeared to have positive effects on attitude and behavior. That then led to a 2016 study, which showed it eased depression and anxiety in patients with life-threatening cancer. Today, psychedelics are studied at institutions all across the country. There are dozens of clinical trials underway and hundreds of scientific papers being published. However, early clinical trials focused on depression, addiction, and anxiety, as where trials have evolved to more recently explore the effect of psilocybin on the treatment of anorexia, migraine headaches, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Funding for psychedelic medicine companies is the big thing here. It's growing very rapidly. Consumer interest in hallucinogenic drugs is also growing very rapidly, and this makes for a very hot market for investors and companies looking to get in here into this industry. In fact, one in 10 US adults takes an antidepressant. They work slowly, antidepressants do. They typically have side effects. Antidepressants from the pharmaceutical antidepressants typically will dampen the symptoms, but they don't really get to the root of the problem. And this is where psychedelic treatment could be much, much different. Because psilocybin in particular has been shown to have a positive effect in treating depression, anxiety, addiction, and has been suggested as a potential treatment for obesity, PTSD, cluster headaches, and much more. Ibogaine has also shown promise as an anti-addiction drug, among other indications. In fact, UC Davis neuroscientist and associate professor David Olson is trying to develop drugs with healing power of a psychedelic experience without the trip, without the hallucinogenic part of the experience. He's recently created two drugs that research suggests stimulate the brain like psychedelics, but don't produce the hallucinogenic effects. In 2019, Olson actually co-founded Delix Therapeutics with Nick Haft, managing director of OMX Ventures, a venture capital firm specializing in medicine and science technology in New York. In September, the company closed a $70 million Series A funding round, which will fund clinical trials for the two drugs by the end of 2022. Olson says there are over 500 novel psychedelic-like drugs currently in the pipeline for development as well. Another company that's taking a different approach is Cyrex. They're developing standardized pharmaceutical-grade psychedelics from natural sources, not synthetics. Synthetic versions of psychedelic substances are obviously easier to manufacture in a uniform manner. However, they may not work as well as their natural versions. Itay Haidt, CEO and co-founder of PsyRx, says, quote, "We believe there's a big difference between biological and synthetic molecules, especially in how they interact with receptors in the brain. Synthetics are not as successful as a key fitting into the lock, but it is complicated to work with biological molecules." PsyRx uses a specially created agromedical bioreactor to produce botanic extracts, psilocybin from magic mushrooms, and ibogaine from the root bark of the iboga shrub. Ibogaine's potential to improve SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antidepressants, should be in human trials later this year, actually. Quote, "SSRIs have some very bad side effects on libido and appetite, and patients often stop using them. We believe adding a microdose of ibogaine will counter those effects and make a better drug," Haidt says, emphasizing that microdoses of psychedelic substances do not cause hallucinations. Haidt continued, quote, "There are not yet standards for the regulation of psilocybin, so we expect it will take at least a few months to receive GMP designation for the pharma industry. Hopefully, by the end of next year, we'll have the ability to sell our psilocybin worldwide for clinical research and drug development." Will psychedelic treatments actually be affordable? I think that's really the question. You have to be monitored. It's much different than to prescribe a pill that you're just going to pop and take one every day, and it's going to give you some chemical balance and hope that that takes care of it. It's another to actually go in and have an experience that helps you uncover whatever the underlying reasoning may be that you're experiencing these problems, whatever those problems may be, whether it is addiction, whether it is anxiety, whether it is depression, whatever that might be, whether it's an obsessive compulsive disorder, whether it's an eating disorder, whatever, again, it may be. But that's really the question, will it be affordable? Because again, patients must be monitored during treatments with psychedelic sessions. Quote, "It's certainly my concern that economically disadvantaged people will have a hard time accessing these treatments," says Peter Hendricks, a psychologist and professor at the University of Alabama School of Public Health in Birmingham. A good example of this would be ketamine research, which suggested that the drug was effective in treating depression, and then the FDA approved it. But it was so expensive, this treatment with ketamine, that insurance simply just wouldn't cover it. So it doesn't matter if the treatments are there, if it's so unaffordable that the average person can't get to it, then it's really not going to be a viable solution. Olson says this, quote, "It's like a one percenter type issue. People who have the money to pay for the expensive clinics, they're getting the help they need. The 99% of people who just don't have that type of money," end quote. Continuing, he says, "We need to think about a more scalable alternative, something so safe that you can pick them up at a retail pharmacy and take them as you would ibuprofen. That sounds really nice, but I think there's a little more to the benefits from psychedelics than just popping a pill and being done with it. I think if you don't put in the time and the work with the psychedelic experience, you're not going to get the full benefits of it. Again, you might just be masking the true underlying problems or conditions. In 2018, Olson's team actually demonstrated that psychedelics activate the brain's 5-HT2A receptor, which promotes the creation of new pathways in the brain. This is why some psychedelics can treat mental health conditions with a single dose. Chemicals able to do this are called psychoplastinogens. Olson's research has used the basic skeleton of psychedelic molecules, but he tweaks their components to alter the effects of the drug. And so UC Davis actually owns the patents for the drugs that Olson has been working on and is partnering with Delix to bring them to market. The psychedelic drug market itself, which is what we were really looking at here, was the money. Where is this all going in the future? Is expected to grow by $11 billion by 2027, just a few years away. Investors are obviously chasing the hopes of big pharma returns, which have been through the roof, especially recently with COVID and the drugs being developed and treatments being developed out of that. But people are still continuing to chase the pharma returns because they expect and want big returns out of this aspect of pharmaceutical development as well. But they also, I think, see an opportunity here of an emerging market, which very similar to the cannabis industry. And I think some of them, the combination of that excitement of an emerging market and the opportunity that that presents, combined with the proven track record of pharmaceutical dividends, I think is very enticing for a lot of people, but I also think is very dangerous for the development of the industry. What we don't want, even in the psychedelic realm, just like in cannabis, is we don't want single monopolies coming in, taking it over, big box corporations coming in and buying up all the patents and owning everything and really taking both the plant as well as, with the psychedelics, most of the time their plants as well, taking those out of the hands of the average person to be able to, use as a responsible adult. And so I think there are definitely some interesting ways that this could develop. And I think it's important to consider when they're chasing these returns that they're looking for, that investors are looking for, it's important to consider that there may be less profit in psychedelic treatments, because if you're able to treat something in one session, four treatment sessions, that's not a continuous supply of money coming in the same way it is that you put somebody on Adderall and they just take Adderall for the next 20 years every day. It's a much different scenario. So I think that's something that they should really consider. In fact, London-based Compass Pathways, which also focuses on synthetic psilocybin created from bioengineered microorganisms, in September of 2021, they actually bought the intellectual property portfolio with patent applications for multiple novel psychedelics and empathy-boosting drugs. Again, when they're talking about just take a pill and solve all your problems, that's literally what some of these companies seem to be trying to go after, and they want to own the rights to your happiness, to your artificial happiness, and without making you do any of the introspection and uncovering those things. That's part of the psychedelic experience is facing your demons to a certain extent and really reflecting upon that. And so I think that that is something that is missing from the way that these companies are approaching this whole subject. Another company, New York-based MindMed, is actually in phase 2 clinical trials on an ibogaine derivative called 18-MC. And Hendrix, the University of Alabama psychologist and Matthew Johnson at Johns Hopkins have actually argued in favor of what I'm saying here. They have argued that the transcendent, sometimes spiritual experiences of awe produced by the psychedelic experiences aren't just a side effect, but are integral into how the drugs affect the brain. Quote, "How would a human derive meaning from an experience that has no salient subjective effects or memories?" Hendricks says. Continuing, quote, "Based on what I've seen so far, I think it's very likely that without those subjective effects, you don't get quite the same type of outcomes." David Nichols, the professor emeritus of pharmacology from Purdue University, says again, quote, "Patients of psilocybin-assisted therapy had a very profound experience that really changed their lives dramatically," end quote. But Nichols does think trip-free psychoplastinogens might work for patients with clinical depression who would otherwise take an SSRI. He's more skeptical, though, about their ability to treat those with addictions or severe traumas, which, again, is where you need to do that work. You need to kind of dig in and kind of deal with the root problems that you, that's causing the complications in life as a result. And so I think that it's going to be very interesting, again, to see how that does develop. And it really leads to a question of, is the journey of the psychedelic experience key to the treatment? And I think that's really one of the most important questions here. You know, will they be able to make a psychedelic miracle pill that's a huge cash cow for the pharmaceutical industries? I'm sure at some point they absolutely will do that, and they'll sell it, and millions and billions of people will buy it and take it probably. But I think there is much more research that needs to be done, because I do think that the psychedelic experience part of it is a big part of it. And, you know, you have to say, you know, could the responsible use of psychedelics by adults, you have to wonder if it would lead to a more loving, accepting, and harmonious world. You know, what do you think? You know, I know that it certainly is an impactful thing that, you know, I think would could be beneficial if it's handled in the right manner, just the same way with cannabis. If it's handled in the right manner, it could be really beneficial to humanity. If it's handled poorly and greed and control and power are take it over, then it could lead to something not so pleasant, needless to say. Lastly today, we'll wrap up with a bit of discussion, just something that I find kind of interesting. I saw this story about asteroidal evidence that could explain the biblical stories of Sodom and the walls of Jericho. And it says, an ancient Middle Eastern city now called Tal el Hammam, I hope I say that right, was hit about 36,000 years ago by a base rock that was speeding towards them at about 38,000 miles per hour. Essentially, the rock seems to have exploded in a massive fireball about 2.5 miles above the ground, around 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima atomic bomb. This thing literally ignited everything in its path. It blinded people instantly. The air temperatures rapidly would have risen to well above 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. Clothing would have immediately burst into flames. You know, anything that's more substantial, swords, metal items, spears, mud bricks, pottery, everything just melted, you know, almost instantaneously. You know, almost immediately, the entire city would have been on fire or consumed in just flames and fire of intensity, the likes of which I don't know that anyone had ever seen at that time, certainly.
It's also worth noting that when this explodes above the ground like that, it sends a massive shockwave. And that shockwave, when it smashed into the city, was moving at about 740 miles per hour. And that's way more powerful than the worst tornado that's ever been recorded. And literally, it demolished every building. None of the 8,000 or so people, animals within the city survived. Literally, their bodies would have been torn apart, their bones blasted into small fragments. They would have just been shredded apart and melted almost instantaneously. Interestingly, though, when this was happening there, about a minute later, that's right, 60 seconds roughly later, about 14 miles away to the west of Tal el Hammam, the winds from the blast hit the biblical city of Jericho. Now, you may ask, how do we know that all this actually happened near the Dead Sea in Jordan about a millennia ago? Well, the reason is because there's been a lot of work put into this. It took about 15 years of excavations to uncover the details that have been analyzed and excavated by more than two dozen scientists in 10 states in the U.S., as well as Canada and the Czech Republic. Archaeologists, geologists, geochemists, geomorphologists, mineralogists, paleobotanists, sedimentologists, cosmic impact experts, and medical doctors have all looked at this evidence. And recently, the work that has been accumulated was published in the journal Scientific Reports, along with 21 co-authors. Obviously, a lot of work and a lot of people involved into going into this. They actually discovered, the archaeologists did, discovered a dark five-foot thick layer of charcoal, ash, and melted earth as they were excavating the area. And this is known as the destruction layer. And it was obvious an intense firestorm is what had destroyed it. And you can kind of see this in the image being there shown. They knew that this wasn't being caused by a volcano. It wasn't caused by an earthquake. It wasn't caused by warfare due to the heat intensity that was required to melt these objects and to have this kind of impact. Volcano, earthquake, warfare, none of those things could have gotten to that intensity or created those conditions. So what the researchers and archaeologists did is they used the online impact calculator to model different scenarios. And what this calculator does, it was built by impact experts. It actually allows researchers to estimate the many details of a cosmic impact event based on known impact events and nuclear detonations. At Tal el Hammam, it seems to have been a small asteroid similar to the one that knocked down 80 million trees in Tunguska, Russia in 1908, which is probably the most famous asteroidal air blast, explosion in the sky above the earth to have occurred in not our lifetime, but most recently, at least. This is a much smaller version of the giant asteroid that likely pushed the dinosaurs into extinction about 65 million years ago. And evidence from the site showed shocked quartz, which is another indicator that something very dramatic. It kind of indicates that it was an asteroidal impact, most likely, because what's needed here to form this shocked quartz, they only form at 725,000 pounds per square inch of pressure. And the destruction layer, it's also worth noting, also contains tiny nano diamonds, which, if you're not sure what that is, each one is actually smaller than a flu virus. And it seems like the heat and pressure turns wood and plants into this diamond-like material. And the laboratory experiments have actually showed that the pottery and mud bricks from Tal el Hammam liquefied at temperatures above 2,700 degrees. Now, that's hot enough to melt an automobile within just a few minutes. The destruction layer, digging further, also contains spherules, which are tiny balls of melted material smaller than airborne dust particles. They're made of vaporized iron and sand that melted at about 2900 degrees Fahrenheit. Surfaces of pottery and melt glass are speckled with tiny melted metallic grains, including iridium, with a melting point of 4400 degrees Fahrenheit, and platinum that melts at 3200 degrees Fahrenheit, and zirconium silicate at 2800 degrees Fahrenheit. Cumulatively, evidence shows the temperature rose higher than volcanoes, warfare, and normal city fires, which we already touched on. This leaves cosmic impact as really the only natural process left as a possibility. And the same evidence is found at known impact sites such as Tunguska and the crater in Mexico, which was created by the asteroid that triggered the dinosaur extinction. Evidence also indicates the city and general area were abandoned for about 600 years afterward. This is theorized that it was because of high levels of salt that were deposited back on the area after the impact, because of the impact, and it basically made the area impossible for crops to grow there. The theory could be that part of the Dead Sea was vaporized, creating toxic levels of basically dead sea salt vapor that spread across the valley. And, you know, there's a likelihood that with other settlements around, there was an oral description of the city's destruction that was probably handed down for generations until it was recorded and the biblical story of Sodom. Because the Bible actually describes the devastation of an urban center near the Dead Sea. Stones and fire fell from the sky. More than one city was destroyed. Thick smoke from the fires and the city inhabitants were killed. Was the biblical account an actual eyewitness account? If so, Tal el Hammam may be the second oldest destruction of a human settlement by a cosmic impact event after the village of Abu Harimia in Syria about 12,800 years ago. More importantly, it may be the first written record of such a catastrophic event at all. And it almost certainly won't be the last time a human city faces this fate. There are airbursts that can devastate entire cities and regions. And when you look at the different flow of asteroids, of comets in space, I think that there really is a modern day hazard here that no one is really thinking about. As of September 2021, there were more than 26,000 known near-Earth asteroids and 100 short-period near-Earth comets. One will inevitably crash into the Earth at some point. And we know that millions more of these asteroids and comets remain undetected. Unless orbiting or ground-based telescopes detect them, we may not have any way to even know. Do we really take this kind of threat serious enough? I mean, there are all these things here on Earth that we can feasibly tackle, all these things that we are divided upon. But this is the one thing that has, you know, really opened up a lot of conversation, made for a very interesting exploration and a different way to look at history. You know, if you don't know the work of Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson, who are, I would consider, experts on this field, I would highly encourage you to look into that, because it really makes you think about the real possibility that we are a civilization with amnesia. That I'm not saying that people had 747s and internet hundreds of thousands of years ago, but I think there's a very distinct possibility, a very real possibility, that humanity may have evolved and flourished in different ways many times over, and may have faced also many catastrophic events that have nearly wiped humanity off the face of the earth and basically forced us into a reset period. When you think about that much time having passed, people that are like, well, where is the evidence from that, from archaeological evidence? And you have to think, if something has been around for hundreds of thousands of years, there's really not much of a chance that there's going to be anything left of that. And I think as I have looked into it, it seems like the most, unfortunately, the thing that lasts the longest is simply stone structures. You know, you look at those, the megaliths, I think those are our best indicators that there once was something, and that maybe we have not looked into it deeply enough with an open mind and have just accepted the traditional story of humanity's history. I also think, you know, there's, you know, the movie that came out, Don't Look Up, it was really hyped as a climate movie. I didn't really see it as a climate movie. I really saw it as, why aren't we pointing every satellite into space trying to find these rogue comets and asteroids? Because literally, I think that's a comical, but yet sadly could be possibly a partial reality of how, you know, our leadership would react to such a situation. And so I think that it is something that needs a little more insight into it and attention into it. But that's just what I think. What do you think? Do you think we should be devoting more time into staring up at the sky and trying to look for dangers that might be hurtling toward us at extinction level event speeds? Should we, you know, not care at all and just live our lives and just let it go and not worry about it? And when it smacks into us, it smacks into us. I like to be prepared, but I'm curious to know what everybody else out there thinks. So please leave your comments below. Please like and subscribe if you like this content. And until next time, peace and love to the people of the planet Earth.